Every second wants to creep by like an hour. Every day wants to crawl by like a year. Inside this red-eyed migraine skeleton pain. Hey, I want some peace in here. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABAClub.org desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Randy P., he's something else. I'm telling you, you guys get ready. Very humble guy. He's gone through hell, and he's helped so many people. He's from Athens, Georgia. I'm so glad he drove over tonight in this weather. We're grateful. Please come up and join us, Randy.
My name is Randy Parsons. I'm just another alcoholic. I tell that to me, not to you, because I still have an ego. Needs deflating. More times than I'd like to admit to. So I remind myself that I am just another alcoholic. I'm nothing special. You know, this is... I've had three God things happen to me in the last hour and a half. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never, ever admitted I had anything from God happen to me. And that reading I had marked in my book, I was going to read that about our stories disclose how we find that relationship with that power greater than us that can solve our problem. You'll have to excuse me. I was sick last week, and I guess I'm glad that I'm not sick this week. Didn't have to call this off. But these God things, I'm going to tell you right quick before I forget them. I'm up here with my sponsor. He's sitting back in the back of the room. Make sure I don't lie to y'all. Bill's sitting up here on the front row. Make sure I don't lie to y'all. Larry's sitting over here beside him to make sure I don't lie to y'all. So maybe I won't lie to y'all. Anyway, me and my sponsor ride down the road. None of this area looks like it used to look a long time ago. First time I came up here, not to this building, but up here in this area, the 85 went right beside the old rock wall way over that way. It ain't where it is now. It used to be a Buick company set up on top of a hill a long time ago. So I've been around a day or two. Not in here, though. Anyway, we stopped to eat at a place right up here on the corner, and we'd done rode up the road, down the road, and up, you know, couldn't find where we wanted to eat at, so we stopped at a Wendy's up there, and we're sitting there eating, and all of a sudden I hear this voice, and I said, I've heard that voice before, and it was Bill and Marlene coming on in. You know, wow, what a deal, and Mark. And we sat there and we talked a little bit there, and then sitting back there talking to my sponsor, Jimmy, and I'd been communicating with Larry via email. Now, y'all, that may not be a big deal for y'all, but I've been communicating on email for about 6 months. I'm going to get me a yaller chip one of these days here. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly.
You ain't Texan?
No, I don't go into Texan. That's a little too much advanced for me. But I'll read it. But if you want to talk to me, you better call me and talk to me. Anyway, so we talk, you know, and I walk out and tell Jimmy, I said, what a God shot. That wasn't where they were planning to eat. Wasn't where we planned to eat. They weren't planning to be here tonight. But they ended up with things happening. God shot. Larry comes in and we talk. And I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say it in a kind and gentle way, I hope, that we might have just one brief moment of silence for a friend of ours, I won't tell you who may possibly be attending his last meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as we speak tonight. So just a moment of silence. All right. So anyway, then there's another little God shot. And then in comes this long, tall fella with the name Diane. He's going to kill me one of these days. And it's an inside joke, and it's funny as a dickens if you ever get to know it. But anyway. So there I see Frank, you know. And I started remembering about this place here. First meeting I ever came to here, where I was about 3 years sober. I was attending some training right up the road over here at the DeKalb Addiction Clinic. Some of y'all may know where that is and may have been there. I was not in there. I was trying to learn how to help us out of there. But they brought us to a meeting over here, and that began a long, long journey to getting back here tonight. Three most important things I tell you tonight are this. The first thing is I have a home group. That's the alumni group in Athens, Georgia. I like to say they send you their best. That's me. Don't tell them I said that, though. We meet on Sunday night at 6:30 for an open speaker meeting, and every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock for an open discussion meeting. If you're ever down that way, look in the book under R. Parsons. Call me up. I'll help you get to the meeting, tell you where it is, whatever. Love to have you. Tim, I think I want to thank you for letting me be here, wherever you are. Second most important thing I'll tell you is I have a sponsor. Like I said, he's sitting right back there. He works a program out of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. He's my third sponsor. Now, this gets weird. All three of my sponsors were named Jimmy, Jim, and Jimmy. Now, I don't know what that's got to do with anything, but I take it as another little sign from God, you know. Because I think God's all involved in this old boy's life today. And when I got here, I didn't want to hear about God, but I'm sorry if you don't want to hear about it, you know. All I can tell you is keep coming back. Maybe you'll find a little path that'll be a little easier for you, because I didn't want to hear about it either. But those people kept talking about it, and it says that in the book somewhere. That means, of course, we're going to talk about God. Third most important thing is I have a sobriety date. That's August the 17th, 1991. That may not impress you. It impresses the hell out of me. I promise you it makes the streets you ride on a lot safer. Just to show you part of my... I probably wouldn't have told this somewhere else because I wouldn't have thought about it. But way back when them old roads was like they used to be, 85 went into 75 down here, and it went down a little grade, and there was a big hill right on the right-hand side when it turned back into 75. All that's changed. Well, me and a couple of my old buddies, you know, we were coming up here, and I think we were trying to go to the Southeastern Fair. I think. And we had an old piece of junk car like we used to drive, and still drive one, but it's a little newer piece of junk. A cooler full of beer, of course. Front seat was a concrete block. you sit on over here on this side, and you had to be careful when around the curve fast. You know, but the car quit running right there where 85 goes on to 75. Now, we ain't got no money. They hadn't even dreamed about a cell phone or didn't know nobody or nothing, you know. So, what do? Me and my old buddy, we decided, well, the police will eventually come and get this car. So we drug that cooler full of beer up that hill and sat on top of that hill and watched traffic ride up and down the road for several hours in the middle of downtown Atlanta drunk. And it'd take too long to explain to you how it all worked out, but we ended up running into some people we knew. How does that happen? Like maybe a God shot, maybe the devil, I don't know. And we ended up getting back home, you know, back to Athens somehow. That's just one of the many crazy things that happened to me along this journey. I told you August 17th, 1991 is my sobriety date. That's really, really important in another way. And hopefully I'll get to that a little later in the talk. I'm going to do my best to get y'all out of here by 1:30. A friend of mine down home says, if you get tonight, my job is to talk, and your job is to listen. And if you get tired of listening before I get done talking, so you're free to leave. It won't bother me a bit. But hopefully I'll get you out of here pretty close to on time. I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here. I don't have a canned talk, but, you know, I can't remember what I said the last time I got up here, so it wouldn't do any good to have one. I've got a really, 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 really good memory. I mean really good memory. It's just really, really short. And when I keep up with things like that, and y'all laugh with me too, because if you don't, we're going to go back talking about God. I am amazed, you know, to be standing up here sober in front of you tonight. You know, I don't know if I was an alcoholic when I was born or not, but I can tell you I was self-centered to the core, though I did not want to admit it. The book tells me that's the root of all my troubles, selfishness and self-centeredness, and I've eaten up with a whole bunch of both of them. My first sponsor used to ask me, he said, Randy, when you were a kid and you got a present for Christmas or birthday or whatever, did you ever care about the person that gave it to you? Or was it just about the present? It was just about the present. I didn't care about the person. Not my mama, not my daddy, not nobody. I thought the world owed Randy P. everything. And when you didn't want to pay off, I just took it. I took whatever you had, made it mine, convinced myself that I'd always owned it. And, you know, it didn't bother me a bit to hurt you to take your stuff. I grew up in a well family until I came along and they got real sick, I think. About 13 is when I really started taking off into drinking. Probably should have needed a meeting, you know. I could have attended one at that time. But I had no desire to stop because I was just really finding what I thought was a solution about that time. Alcohol was making decisions for me by that age. I wasn't getting into a lot of trouble yet, but it was already making decisions. It made decisions who my friends were. You know, when I was coming up, I was around a lot of good folks. But I can tell you, in the end, they'd all gone on, got married, had families, had jobs, made something out of their life. And I'm wondering, sitting there wondering, well, wonder what's happening. But I'm still sitting in the bar, or the trap, or the juke joint, or the honky-tonk, crying in my beer, fighting, going outside and stealing your stuff so I can get another drink, doing whatever it takes to get loaded, and wondering how I'd missed out on life. I go back right quick, and my story will jump all over everywhere too, so just put up with me. Hopefully in the end I'll be sober. I was a good athlete. I haven't always been this big. I played football, basketball, baseball in high school. Excuse me, did pretty good at it. I had the opportunity to go on to college and attend the university, six different universities, some of them small, but they were still universities, to play football and not have to pay for my education. But alcohol had started already controlling my life by that time, 17 years old, you know. I mean, God, I went up to Boone, North Carolina, and at Appalachian State, and they offered me at that time all they offered was a half scholarship. And they offered me that, and the first thing I wanted to know, the guy that took me around the campus up there, I said, you know, I've been looking around, and I don't see no orange balls in the windows, or no liquor signs, or no beer signs. He said, oh, well, they don't sell alcohol in this town. You got to go 17 miles down the road to this little town called Blowing Rock. I ain't walking that far for no drink. And in the end, I did. But I didn't then, you know. So I threw that away, and I turned down the other scholarships and proceeded to head on out on the journey of Randy's life. Drank a lot, did a lot of crazy things. I don't need to tell you all of those things. Just suffice it to say that I never, ever was arrested if I wasn't breaking the law. You know, they did not come, as my friend down home says, they didn't come get me out of the quiet church and say, you're singing too loud, and lock me up. Now, it don't matter if it's a good law, bad law. I was always breaking the law whenever I was arrested. I had a lot of enablers in my life. I had a lot of enablers in my family. I had a lot of enablers in judges. I had a lot of enablers in district attorneys. I had a lot of enablers in lawyers. And I didn't have to do a lot of time that I probably should have had to do. You know, I believe with all my heart there are two kind of people in this world today. There's the caught and the uncaught. Yeah. I was kind of semi-caught. You know, but I went on through my early teens there and late teens, and things were just not good, not bad. They were just the way they were. And I went on to the University of Georgia finally after I got kicked out of Gainesville Junior College for bootlegging up there. They didn't have any alcohol up in that area either, but I had a big old Rambler station wagon, and I come through Arcade every day, and I'd load up, drive up there and unload, and made a few bucks. Somehow all my dealing was always, I ended up being my biggest customer. Some of y'all understand that, maybe. I went to the university, and I tell you quickly on that deal, I thought I had a couple of years at the University of Georgia. When I got my transcript after I got sober, I had signed up over a period of 2 years at the University of Georgia. But I had 22 hours in 2 years, so, I mean, you can, if you know anything about it, that ain't a whole lot. That means I didn't attend very well. But, you know, I never did attend much of anything very well as I come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still go to, at least a meeting a day. It's just where I need to be. Unless I'm sick. You know, that's just where I need to be. And I have the opportunity to do that today. But anyway, life kind of clicks on along. And I'm 20 years old, and I'm working down there in Athens, a little honky-tonk, you know, working about 7 hours a week, taking a whole handful of white pills every day, trying to stay awake so I can keep working. So I keep talking to the people that come in, you know, bartenders got a... You ever get to where your mind and your voice get out of sync? And your thinking and your talking gets out of whack? It's hard to get straightened up when you do that. But I was running that little old honky tonk down there, and every day at 2 o'clock after the lunch rush, or what we called a rush anyway, I went to the corner liquor store. And I got me a bottle of George Deacon White Label. Every day. And I drank a quart of George Deacon White Label liquor every day. On top of all the beer, see, I drank beer until 2 o'clock. Then it was time to drink liquor. Well, one day, you know, I'd been just doing a whole lot of drinking, and we used to take a lot of mind-expanding chemicals. I think we were searching for God. You know, we'd go on trips without ever leaving home. Strange places, strange things. Had long hair down to my butt. Up until September the 25th, I had a shaved head. It's kind of growing back. I'm thinking I may grow it back to my rear end again. Who knows? Just might piss somebody off, you know. Taking all them pills and working in that little joint, and finally, you know, it hit me that I'm probably missing out on something in life. You know, these one-night stands that were not one night long were kind of getting old, and some of y'all must understand what I'm talking about. I must be in the right place. I had met this gal, and she was my best friend's girlfriend. I have to tell this. And being a guy of high upstanding moral fiber that I was, I wouldn't ever fool with another man's woman. And I ain't figured out yet how me and that woman ended up in that bathtub. It just blows my mind how something like that could happen. Well, me and my best friend's girlfriend got to being me and her was boyfriend-girlfriend kind of deal, and he was kind of out the window, you know. Y'all know about that. And finally, I did the most foolish thing I've ever done in my life. The first most foolish thing I ever done. I asked that woman to marry me. Now, I'm a long-haired hippie. I'm working in a honky-tonk bar. I'm taking little white pills to keep my eyes open wide, drinking all I can pour down my throat, making about $2.50 an hour. Going to get married and have a family. But I didn't read the book. I just don't do it, you know. And we decided to get married, and boy, that was weird, too. That's a long time ago. I'm having to remember this. The night before we got married, some of my compadres decided to give me a little bachelor party. And right before that ended, I was standing on. We live in this old hippie house. Y'all know about old hippie houses. Got a whole bunch of folks live in this room. A whole bunch of folks live in that room. You know, just a whole bunch of folks. Nobody ever knows who's really living there. We just kind of, hey, who are you? How you? Where you from? You know, what? And the last thing that I remember was I had chugged a bottle of champagne. Now, I hated champagne, even back then. But I did it, you know. Getting married tomorrow, got to do something. I chugged that bottle of champagne, and about that time, the damn front door flew open. And it wasn't visitors. Was people with big badges and big guns, and they were coming to bust the big drug dealing house in Athens. And we didn't deal no drugs. We couldn't even afford to take what we were taking. That's what it is. You know, maybe it's just, I don't know, I think they had a miscommunication there somewhere. Anyway, you know, go through the whole rigmarole, and they're going to take everybody downtown and put us all in jail and get us bonded out, I reckon. And I told the guy that came in talking to me, I said, listen, if you don't let me go outside and puke, now I puke, I don't throw up, I don't regurgitate, I puke. If you don't let me go outside and puke, I'm going to puke on you. And he politely let me go outside, and I threw up. We had an old flea-bitten couch out there on the front porch. Some of y'all understand about that, too. And that thing looked good. And I went over there and I laid down on that thing. And I took me a little nap. You know? I had a wonderful ability. I thought it was I could go to sleep anywhere. What it'd do, I'd pass out anywhere. But I laid down on that, went to sleep, and they hauled everybody to jail. And they got downtown to the jail, and they started counting off numbers, and they was one short. And they loaded back up some of them in the car, and they sent it back over at the house, and there I was. So they made me go down there. All I want to do is go to sleep for a while. I never did think my drinking was bad. I just thought the problems that happened was other people's fault, and they just kept happening. Anyway, that we had a big party the next day, and you know, you would think that people have enough sense at a supposed drug dealing hippie house not to have a big party with 150 hippies, 5 kegs of beer, music turned to the ceiling, out in the yard, some of them with clothes on, some of them without, would have no sense not to do that. Nope. Police had to come over 5 times to tell us to turn it down. Those are the kind of things I did, folks. Nothing really bad. Just a lot of insanity. You know? And I thought I had too much money to go to jail. The laws are made for y'all. I still didn't know that I drank because I had to drink. I drank because I wanted to drink, thank you. And I thought that up until I come around here. That I could drink. I didn't have to drink. And I went to treatment. They kind of got me convinced. You know, I like that spring water these folks come up with. But I have never yet sat down and drank 3 cases of that stuff. Never. But I drank all the alcohol I could pour down. Lived through that time, got married. Marriage went off and on, you know, rocked along. And I have to own this part of it, too. It's full of violence and threats of violence. A lot of domestic violence in there I'm not proud of, but it happened. Even let her talk me into going to counseling one time, marriage counseling. I went drunk. The man said, well, what, Randy, he sent her out of the room after she told him all this lies about me. Y'all know how that works. He said, y'all don't mind if I do this, do you? I started coming in my shorts, which is about all I wear. Anyway, he asked me, he said, well, tell me what the problem is. I said, she pisses me off. I mean, now that's all I could answer. And people said, well, how do you feel? Well, I feel like S-H-I-T. No, you don't. But I didn't know anything. I didn't know how I felt. I didn't know what the problem was. And the problem was me, and the problem was alcohol, and I had no clue. And I got married again, and that marriage was the same way, and it was full of threats of violence and tearing up stuff, and I'd knock windows out. And let me tell you this, don't do this. Do not drop kick your television while it's plugged in. Big ball of fire come out of that thing and get you. Do not do that. That second marriage produced a child. A beautiful little girl. She was born January the 8th, 1985. She'll tell you right now that Elvis Presley was born on her birthday. She has a little bit of self-centeredness about her. I'm praying that she gets in these rooms one day to stay. She certainly needs what you people have to offer. We had that child, and finally, by the grace of God, that wife took that child and left. We had two houses and about 4 acres of land out in Winterville area, and she left me. Best thing she could do before somebody died. Rocked on along probably another year or two, and finally the take back man, you know how the take back man is. If you don't pay them, they won't come take back at whatever it is they let you have. This man had let me get 2 years in arrears on a mortgage. Now, I'm still working at honky-tonk up there in the middle of normal time, making about $3.50 an hour. Now, how am I going to catch all that up, you know? So the take-back man's going to take back, and I have to tell this part of the story. You know, I had become, on top of being a full-blown alcoholic, I was an IV drug user at that time. I went to clean up that house so I could let it have it back, and I didn't have any running water, I didn't have any electricity, I didn't have any heat, didn't have a telephone, and in my mind, I didn't have a problem. I used the toilet on a 5-gallon paint bucket. I brought gallons of water home, milk gallons of water home to wash what little I washed. There was probably 1,000 dirty syringes laying around all over everywhere. There was 42 pounds of empty beer cans on the floor. The reason I know that is because I bagged them up and sold them to get another drink. And I didn't have a problem. And I called my mama, as many of us do. You know, what do you do when you ain't got nowhere else to go and your mama's still alive? You call mama. Because you see, ladies, I know in your heart, if you have children, your babies are always going to be right there in your arms, no matter how old or how big they get. And my mama said, you can come home for a week, you can clean up, you can get yourself straightened up, you get your job and you get out of our house. And 5 years later, on August the 17th, 1991, you got it. 1 week, 5 years, same amount of time. I walked up the hall in my mama's house. Somehow I had gotten on the phone. I had called a treatment center. Y'all know how it happened because you know that that power greater than me is the one that did it. I called him and he said, come on in and talk to me. And this is after I told him I had a little problem. Just a, you know, little problem. I walked up the hall and I asked my mama to take me to the hospital, and she let out a hoot and a holler, and I thought I'd caused her to have a heart attack. And she took me to the hospital on August the 17th, 1991. At that time, I had a $750 a day drug habit. And I did whatever it took to pay it. I will not give you a total example of everything I did at that time. Suffice it to say, anything. Drank all I could pour down my throat. And I went to, got ready to go to that treatment center, and it's August and it's 800 degrees outside. Balls of sweat, big as silver dollars on my forehead. Y'all know how that kind of happens. And I had those two one's a little angel, one's a little devil. And they kind of sit on your shoulders sometime. I don't know if y'all ever had them, but I had a lot of things talk to me. The little angel said, the little devil said, Randy, you go up there and them people talk to you for about 4, 5, maybe 6 hours. And they'll fix you and they'll send you on home and you'll be okay. And the little angel said, Randy, you better take your cigarettes with you because you ain't coming home. And they did. They let me go 92 days later. I thank them today. I go by there every August and thank them. They've moved locations. I thank them because their program was based on this book right here. They took me into there. They couldn't do it like we do it in here, but they did it good enough to get my attention and to get me moving along. Because, see, I did not want to, I ain't admitting I'm powerless over alcohol. Alcohol's the only thing that's holding me together. I'm ready to get rid of this other white, flaky substance. But we ain't talking about them cold Miller Lights. No. We ain't going there. But that's what's holding me together. And that doctor reached down when the day he took me in there and he slid his hand up in my side. I levitated about 3 foot off of this metal gurney he had me laying on. And I said, "Damn, Doc, you trying to kill me?" He said, "Boy, you done about killed yourself." I didn't even know my liver hurt. You know, they had no clue. But I got in there and I got to moving along and I got out finally after some time and they had got my attention and I started going to AA meetings on my own. I started reading this book here. And folks, I tell you, I'd read this book. Excuse me. I'd read one page from the top to the bottom. I couldn't. I had no more idea what I'd read than a man in the moon. No, I couldn't tell you. But I kept reading. And I kept reading. And I kept reading. And I kept reading. And I'd go back to the top of the page. And every once in a while, it'd be like a light bulb would come on. And I'd go, "Dang, that's what they're talking about. Wow. Where'd that come from?" And I can tell you today, this old book is, so I've got all these different colors in here now, you know, and my first sponsor said, "Don't highlight," because next time the next sentence will mean more than the other one. And, you know, I look at it now and I tell you that I wouldn't no more try to get through life without this book than I would without air. I wouldn't try to get through life without a sponsor. I would not try to get through life without being connected in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would not get through life without working with others. Even now when I go somewhere, and tonight I don't know what I've talked about. If you've heard my story before, you may have heard a different one. I got one story, I just tell it 6 different ways, so whatever. But the bottom line is this. The answers are in this book. And the answers are in those steps. I can't change my thinking. But if I want to live any kind of a happy, joyous, and free life, my thinking must change. There's no maybe it should. It must. There's a heap of must in this book. You know. A whole lot of we took the steps. A whole lot of hopelessness in this book. But there's never a place in here that you get a problem. Never. That the solution isn't following very shortly behind it. Usually within a paragraph or two. There's always going to be there. But I have to keep living it. I have to keep doing it. I have to keep walking through this. I want to share a couple of quick God things with you right fast, and then I know it's time for me to to hush. You know, me and my sponsor have been a lot of places in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been to 2 international conventions. We took an AA history tour. We were going to go to Akron for Founders Day. Somebody suggested, "Well, maybe you ought to go, since you're that far up north, you might want to go to New York and see GSO." And I said, "Well, okay, so we're going to decide to do that." And then they said, "Well, if you're that far up, you might as well go to Stepping Stone, see where Bill and Lois live." "Okay, if you're that far up, you might as well go on over to Vermont and see where Bill was born." Now, we're over there in Vermont, staying in the in the Wilson house. Me and Jimmy have a wonderful relationship. We can ride and we do not have to entertain each other. You know how wonderful a gift that is? You ever riding somewhere with somebody and you think you got to keep the talking going? We'd go 500 miles, never say a word. And okay, wasn't no problem. Sitting there one day on the porch of that house, and I'm in a rocking chair, and I'm looking up that big mountain Bill Wilson was talking about. And I'm rocking, and a fellow come by, and he said, "What's he doing?" So he's always sitting over in that chair. And Jimmy looked at him and said, "He rocking, man." You know, us old Southern boys, we just rock a little bit. Listen to a lot of rock music, too. We went on that history tour. We went to those international conventions. You know, I was walking down the street in Minneapolis, and I hear somebody holler, "Randy!" Now, y'all told y'all I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. Now, there's 70,000 alcoholics up there, but there ain't but one Randy, right? So they got to be talking to me. And it was somebody I knew from the Rock. And for those of you who don't know what the Rock is, that's Atlanta Men's Workshop. We have it twice a year. I'd love to have you down there if you're a man. If you're a woman, it'd be difficult to get you in there. We might not ever get you out. So you might not want to come. But we were standing in line going into the Metrodome up there. There's probably 50 different entrances to this building. The lines are wrapped around the building three different directions. And I hear that Randy again. And I turn around and I look where the voice is coming from, and I don't see anybody I recognize. So I turn back around and then I hear it again. I turn back around, don't recognize anybody. I turn back around, a guy comes up, taps me on the shoulder, and he said, "Randy, my name's so-and-so, and you don't remember me, do you?" I said, "Nope." He said, "You spoke up in North Carolina, and I heard you talk one night, and said, 'I got sober in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and me and my wife were up here on our honeymoon.' Wow. You don't believe in God? Wow." I flew to California. Me and Bill were out in California. Speak for some men out there. You know, my self-centeredness, I'm like, I go out to California and tell them folks how to stay sober. Well, they've been staying sober longer than I have. So, anyway, I tell my story out there, and I thought, you know, that's why I went out there. God had a different plan. After I finished talking, a guy come up to me, and he said, "Randy?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I said, "Nope. I'm getting better about telling you the truth about that. Usually I just say, 'Well, how's your mama and them doing?' You know, be careful because somebody's mama might not be alive." So I've done that. Anyway, he said, "You tried to help me back in Athens, Georgia about 5 years ago down at the old Cobb house." And I just went, "Whoa." You know, I mean, here's God again. I went out there, folks, not to tell my story, but to sit down with that man one-on-one and let him give me an amends to bring back to a man in Athens, Georgia. Now, you don't believe in God? I don't have the power to create these things in my life. You know, my problem is powerlessness. But I'm, by this book here, able to find a relationship with a power greater than me that can solve that problem. I told you about August the 17th, 1991, being an important date. And yeah, that's my sobriety date. That's my mom and daddy's 50th wedding anniversary. And I had no clue. You see, I couldn't remember nobody's birthday because I was always thinking about mine. I couldn't remember anything about anybody else because it was always about me. Always. I'm getting a little better today. little bit. My mama had, she came down with terminal cancer. She had lived through some cancer and allowed herself to become a guinea pig for the drug companies. She said she wanted to help some other women and some of the drugs they gave her. Kept her alive for about another 5 to 7 years, something like that. And see, I'm sure that she maybe have helped some of you ladies may have ended up needing some of her help from those drugs. But I was able to be there and give my mama, in the end of her life, some of the strongest narcotics there are. And I didn't steal them. I didn't take them. Wow. You don't believe in God? You didn't know me. That would have been a license to steal. My daddy got sick shortly after Mama died. In fact, me and Jimmy were down in Macon at the state assembly, and I get one of those calls, and ain't nobody going to call me in Macon at the state assembly. But they did, and they said my daddy had a spill and fell outside. Anyway, long story short, he's in the hospital, and everything inside of him's turning loose. The doctors say we don't know why he's alive. I say it's because my sister ain't got here yet. She gets there, and I was still smoking at that time. So, well, I'm going outside and smoke, and I opened the window, and I went downstairs and told her, I said, if you need me, holler out the window there. I'll be right there. And she did, and I went back upstairs, and Daddy had been he'd been in a coma for several days. He didn't know anything. And his breathing was so just, you know. And I sat down there on the corner of that bed with my daddy, and I put his little hand in my hand, and I remembered when his hand was so big and mine was so little. And I held his hand and I said, Daddy, it's okay, you can go on home. And folks, whether you believe this or not, don't bother me one bit. I know what happened. I know what I saw, and I believe what I saw. My daddy opened his eyes, and he looked at me. He didn't say anything. He looked at me, and I knew he knew who I was. And I'm the son that they couldn't find when they needed me, because I was out drunk and doped up somewhere and laid up. But I'd always find them when I needed to get out of trouble. But they couldn't find me for help. But I was there that night, and my daddy looked at me. And folks, he looked up, and he saw what none of us have ever seen. And the angels came and took my daddy home. And I was there for his last breath. The prodigal son had returned. God has such a sense of humor. I walked out of the hall, and I was going to go tell the nurse, and all the daddy's nurses had been little tiny petite nurses, you know. And I walked up there to tell the nurse, and his nurse that night was a large African-American lady, big as I was. And God knew what I needed. Because I walked up to her, and I said, ma'am, it's finished. And I fell out in her arms. And the tears of years flowed down. And I'm here to tell you tonight, if God hadn't have been involved there, you would have had a different speaker tonight. If one of those little tiny petite nurses had been there, I'd have fell on her, crushed her, killed her, and y'all would have said, he killed a nurse at the hospital. Dadgummit. And I'm glad you laugh with me. You see, I believe recovery's got to have laughter. We've lived in the dark and the misery and gone down to the depths of hell that we don't ever have to go back to again. Ever. That book talks about it. Talks about we can try to work this one day at a time program, but I'm going to tell you folks, I can't fool myself. There ain't no tomorrow about going back out, John. It's got to be the deal or else. I love y'all. I hope you have heard something tonight that you might be able to take with you and use in your recovery. And if it doesn't do anything else, you can say, well, boy, that big old boy, he sure does believe in his God. But he does. I could sit here and talk to you for 3 days and not ever tell you even the beginnings of everything. You just heard a smidgen. But I hope you heard enough to know that no matter how far down the scale you have gone, no matter to what depths you have gone to, that there is one who has all power that can lift you up and bring you right on up here and put you right behind this microphone when he gets ready. I love you all. Thank you much.
That's what we call working with others. We're not a glum lot, right, Larry? At the Atlanta Men's Workshop, it's a tradition for Randy Parsons to give out the chips. But this time around, I'm going to ask his friend Bill Sanders to help us out. They're lined up right here for you.
I am Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. Randy, I can honestly and truly say that that was one of the most adequate talks I ever heard. That's a private joke between us. You know I love you, brother. Thank you, always. You asked me to do this tonight, and Randy talked about God things. This is a God thing for me. And I'm going to explain that, but I'm going to do it in a few minutes. We'll take care of something else first. Let's find out who here has something to celebrate. Here at Alcoholics Anonymous, the NABA Club, and most everywhere else I know in the civilized world, they celebrate. We celebrate our recovery milestones with these little poker chips that mean nothing to most people, but everything to us. If you are sick and tired of your way and want to at least give it a try our way, we offer you a white chip. Or if you're coming back from writing new chapters in your story that weren't any better than the ones you left, we offer you the white chip. Anyone tonight want to take a white chip? You're beginning the greatest journey of your life. After 30 days and 30 nights in a row, we offer you the silver chip. Anyone have 30 days? Okay. After 90 days, a red chip. Anyone have 90 days? After 6 months, I call this the gold chip. Anyone going for the gold? 9 months, green chip. And after years or multiples of years, we offer you a blue chip. Anyone that I'm not aware of that has a blue a year tonight? Tim, I said this was a God thing because you asked me to give out the chips tonight, and it affords me an opportunity to do something that I haven't done in a long time. There's a man here tonight that I haven't seen in a good while. We've communicated and we've talked, but I haven't seen him in a while. We were part of each other's lives for many, many years. We still are, but we're just in different areas now. And I'm going to get an opportunity to present a chip to somebody that I love very much. Larry, come up here. I was Larry's sponsor for a number of years, and knowing him as I do, it's also a very much of a God thing that this man has made it for 25 years without having a drink. Almost as amazing as me. I love this man dearly. He loves this fellowship. He lives by it. He shares it. And it's with a lot of love and respect that I present him with this chip. And I love you so much. Thank you, buddy.
My name is Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic. This one ain't about me. Randy said tonight that we were going to take a moment of silence for a very special man. That man has a name, and his name is Charlie Yell. He stood at this very podium a few times. Charlie's my best friend. He travels the globe with me for 12-step work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And tonight, Charlie Yell, if he made it, I was holding him yesterday in Savannah, Georgia. If he made it to this moment, he's standing where I'm standing at his home group in the Savannah group, picking up his 19 years tonight. But where Charlie is right now is all God's business. The call that I received on the way here is that nobody expects Charlie to make it through the night. But when I looked at Charlie yesterday, I said, I understand you're going to try to make it to your home group tomorrow night. Charlie's voice was as booming as Bill's at one point, but cancer has completely riddled his body. And in a little tiny, quiet whisper, he says, no, I'm going to get my chip tomorrow night. I'm going to my home group. So this one is for Charlie. And if you never got to know him, never got to meet him, you never had the honor of hearing his booming voice and his story about unifoot slippers from the podium, get your hands on one of his CDs. I love that man, and I can't wait to see him down the road because I know I'm going to. Thank you guys for all that you've done for me over these 25 years.
Congratulations, Larry. I can help you guys out if you want to hear Charlie's story. We have a page on the website that's not a Monday night speaker page. It's other NABA notable speakers. And Charlie Y told a story to the men's group here about 2 years ago. It can be downloaded from NABAClub.org. So our prayers are with Charlie.
On that broad highway, on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.